Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vagam Radian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. As Michael Baer and Arnold Panaro joined us earlier in the week for an update on the presidential transition, they're going to join us next week when we resume our regular transition coverage at its normal time every Friday as part of our Washington Roundtable. It has been an extraordinary week. Joining us today to discuss what to expect from a Democratic Senate and what the nation has to do in the wake of the storming of the Capitol, Dr. Gordon Adams, a fellow at the Quincy Institute and the Stimson Center and professor emeritus at American University, Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners, Michael Herson of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense lobbying firms, our producer, Chris Cervello, who's a retired United States Navy commander and Navy spokesman, who's co-founder of the Provision Advisors PR firm, and former Pentagon comptroller, Dr. Dov Zakheim, who among his many hats is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Everybody, thanks very much for joining us.
Happy to be here, Vago.
Great to be back, Vago.
Great to be back.
Thanks, Vago.
Thanks, Vago.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Everybody, thanks very much for joining us. Glad that we're back in regular order. Everyone was hoping that 2021 would be better than 2020. But as our mutual friend Ilan Berman of the American Foreign Policy Council yesterday joked, after a seven-day trial period, he'd like to give 2021 back. All eyes were on the Georgia race for Congress and whether the President Trump's tenure would get any more chaotic. And as expected, it ended as violently as his critics have long warned. I should note for our audience that two of those critics join us today. Dov Zakheim was among those who wrote twice about the president's unfitness for office. And Gordon, I know that you did as well very early in his presidency. The members of his cabinet are resigning in the wake of what happened up on Capitol Hill on Wednesday, including Betsy DeVos, the Education Secretary, Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao, as well as others, Matt Pottinger, Deputy National Security Advisor. But as some have pointed out, this is like joining the French Resistance in May 1945. It's a little bit less brave than joining the French Resistance in May 1940. I'd like to start with the Georgia race and what it means before moving on to discuss President-elect Joe Biden's reorganization of the National Security Council, and then, of course, to discuss the insurrection and what it means and how the nation has to deal with it. Michael, start us off. Georgia win was very, very big. It was close, but now that means the Senate plus one vote, with the vice president being the tiebreaker, is going to be in control. Jack Reed becomes the Rhode Island Democrat, will swap seats with the current chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Jim Inhofe. Jack Reed is less public than some of his colleagues, but he's also one of the most respected members of his members of Congress, or the Senate, I should say. Former Army officer, West Point grad, extremely experienced, very wise counsel, discreet, and somebody who's genuinely decent. Start us off on where you think he's going to be leading the committee and some of the other changes that are going on up in the Hill, given that with Democratic control, Democrats are now in charge, and that means new people in charge.
Sure. So let's talk with the broader impact of the Senate races, because now it does provide an opening for Joe Biden's agenda, although which will still have to be narrow, but it does provide a little more room for him to move. So the first thing they're going to do, and they're going to need to act fast, because Democrats and the Biden administration feel that they cannot miss early opportunities to combat the COVID crisis and reverse its effects on the economy. If they don't, this could cripple the rest of Biden's presidency. So he's going to come out of the gate with another relief package to try and give Americans $1,400 more in direct payments, plus the $600, which would get to the $2,000 number that's been bantied around, plus aid for state and local governments and money for vaccine distribution. Then In the spring, this is going to be the big test through what they can do through reconciliation, which means with the Democrats now controlling the Senate, with the deciding vote being Kamala Harris, they don't have to get 60 votes in order to pass legislation when they do things through reconciliation. So he's going to try and do an infrastructure plan and a tax plan. And that's going to be tough because he's going to need every single senator to vote for that. And in the House, they cannot afford to lose more than 4 votes. So that will be a big test and a big challenge. Then as far as, Jack Reed.
And that's assuming no member changes parties, right? Because all eyes have been on Joe Manchin, the conservative Democrat, and whether he would shift seats. I know that his camp has said that that's not going to happen. But, right, all you need is one fatality, one indictment, a couple of guys leaving, and the whole ball game changes back, right?
Absolutely. Excellent point. And that rumor was floating around a lot, although I think after Wednesday's events, I think it becomes even less likely that Manchin would switch parties. But, the fallout continues day by day. But I think that's an excellent point, which is why I think the Biden folks are going to need to move quickly on these things. It does have big impacts for the national security on the Hill, especially the Armed Services Committee in the Senate, because Jack Reed will be taking over the helm. As you pointed out, I know that Dove is very close with the new chairman, very well respected. I engage in a conversation with him about once every quarter with a small group of folks, always very thoughtful, always very straightforward, always very honest. I think that the relationship between him and Smith will go well when it comes time to negotiate a conference. I think it'll be less tenuous than the relationship can be with Senator Inhofe. Jack Reed was very supportive of Inhofe, during the years of Inhofe's chairmanship. So I think Reed would expect the same back in return. There will be, some possible changes on the subcommittees now that with Democrats taking over those chairmanships. The one that watch will be the Sea Power Subcommittee. I've heard that Senator Hirono from Hawaii, who is the ranking member, will choose not to take the chairmanship, that she wants to take a chairmanship on another committee. So then Gene Shaheen would be next in line, but Gene Shaheen now would be chair of a subcommittee on appropriations. So it means that Senator Blumenthal could possibly become the chairman of the Sea Power Subcommittee. And that would put Connecticut in a very strong position when it comes to sea power, because Joe Courtney from Connecticut already chairs the sea power subcommittee in the House. So those are some of the big changes that could be coming on as far as national security is concerned with the committees in light of the 50-50 Senate.
Dove and Gordon and Chris, I want to bring you in on this as well, given that you all interacted directly. You, Dove, I think you, Senator Reed, was a co-sponsor of yours to become the comptroller of the Pentagon. Gordon, I know you've both, testified and worked with Senator Reed. And Chris, I know your bosses have interacted closely with him. Really quickly, walk us through in terms of what you guys expect and how you expect not just the change in Congress more broadly and some of the figures who are going to be coming in and what the change of power mean, but also what Jack Reed as chairman means. Dove, why don't you start us off?
Sure. I think everything that Mike said about Jack Reed is absolutely accurate. Let me add a little bit of color to that. Because he's low key, and you see this when you speak to him privately as well, I think Mike could confirm this and maybe Gordon as well, he can work easily with a lot of different people. My other co-sponsor, by the way, was John McCain. And Reed would go out and travel with McCain just to demonstrate that armed services issues were bipartisan. That's the kind of person he is. And so he'll be able to work. He's worked with Inhofe before. He'll be able to work with Rogers over at, in addition to Smith. And what's really important is that he is an acolyte of Carl Levin when he was chairman. And Levin was particularly doubtful about missile defense. And so it's going to be interesting to see where Reed comes down on that particular issue. And more generally, where Reed comes down on efficiency issues, the kinds of things that Mac Thornberry and McCain used to lead on, but they're both out of McCain, of course, has passed and Thornberry has retired. And so the question is, will Reed pick that up and run with it? He's got a very fine staff. Liz King, his chief of staff, will probably be chief of staff now, staff director of the committee. She's a very, very capable woman. He's highly respected by the military because of his just whole demeanor. So I think on defense issues, even though everybody and we all on this program have predicted a downturn in the budget, which likely will be even more pronounced. Remember that Bernie Sanders is now going to be the chairman of the budget committee. Nevertheless, I think Reid is the kind of person who can sort of walk that fine line, protect the Pentagon, while at the same time not entirely dissing the left wing that's going to put tremendous pressure, not on him particularly, but on Joe Biden to really slice the military.
I want to point out that one of the other great things about Senator Reid is his unfailing honesty. And when you talk to him, he gives you sort of a very unvarnished take on where things stand and can be honest even on the Democratic side about things that aren't going well or adds to his credibility, right? And as a general rule, when he tells you something or he tells you like this is going to be a problem, you have a tendency of paying attention to somebody who's not doesn't have an ounce of BS artist in him. Gordon?
One of the giveaways in terms of what he's like is when he's issued trip reports every time he's gone overseas, say to Iraq and Afghanistan, and they're really exceedingly thoughtful. They're not superficial at all. Which is what the man is all about.
Gordon?
I agree with everything that's been said about Jack Reid, but let me make, before I comment on that, let me make some broader points in response to what Mike had to say in particular. In addition to what he said, and the reconciliation point I want to underline, the vehicle for Biden to accomplish very quickly, and I think speed's important here, these major things that he wants to do, like a tax bill, like COVID supplement, are going to rely on going through the reconciliation process, which has to involve revenues or spending, which is how you can use the reconciliation procedure. So watch for that as a constitutional or statutory or rulemaking kind of region for this very thin majority to operate in. The second thing to point out is that it not only means that Jack Reid comes into that committee position and key, it not only means that Sanders is in the budget committee, because it's not clear how important the budget committee will play a role here, but Sanders will certainly use that podium actively. It also brings in Patrick Leahy as chair of the Appropriations Committee. And Leahy has a very broad view and a very experienced appropriator in terms of coming into that position and putting him together with Rosa DeLauro in the House is going to be, could be a very powerful team on the appropriations side. The other two things that are important about it, confirmations, it now makes it, with Georgia victories, it makes it possible for him not to have a bunch of fights over confirmations. As long as he holds the Democrats together, he can get his people through. That may be particularly important with respect to Neera Tanden, the nomination for the director of the Office of Management Budget, the office that's going to be critical to putting the president's agenda together. It also means hearings. So if we're going to have investigations and serious hearings on, for example, the things that happened this week, you now have the capacity to hold those hearings in the Senate as well as in the House. And thirdly, it puts people like Collins, Murkowski, Romney, Toomey, Manchin in a very powerful position, because if anybody gets wobbly, they're going to have to be catered to in the middle of the Congress. So that's important. And Jack Reid, careful, judicious, not an ideologue, really important. He is a senator's senator. He's what they call a workhorse, not a show horse. And the few times that I have been able to work with him, he's been open, listens well, reacts well, asks good questions. He'll be a very serious, good, excellent, I think, workhorse. Not so clear he's going to be a strategic thinker, but I don't think we've had anybody who's a strategic thinker since Sam Nunn in the chairmanship of the SASC. So we're not going to major reconsiderations of strategy here. That's a kind of a weakness at this point, because we really do have some serious strategic reconsidering to do in the architecture. And then one little asterisk, what will Mitch do? Because even with him as minority rather than majority leader, the rules opportunities to make life difficult for the administration or make cooperation possible still leave a lot in the hands of the minority leader. And the judgment is out as yet as to exactly whether he wants to work cooperatively or try to bring down the administration in the first 2 years.
Just note that you pointed out the power of the Connecticut representation. With Reid at Rhode Island, you've got a lot of people who commute over to Connecticut, and that's just going to add further power to that particular part of the country.
Chris, let me ask you, I mean, obviously, you know, you worked for a lot of senior Navy leaders and were in some of these meetings. Two-part question, sort of your sense on where all this goes, the relationship, what Senator Reid brings to the party, but also whether this doesn't augur really, really well for the United States Navy, given the kind of composition and leadership we're going to have in position from very, very prominent shipbuilding or nearby states.
So I would agree with all of the descriptors that the guests prior to me used. That was certainly they all match how I saw Senator Reid engage with, whether it was CNO Richardson or you know, Vice Chief Moran or others. I would double down on the point that Dove made about protecting the Pentagon, except I would add that I always saw him as the type of senator that protected the Pentagon from themselves. He had a way of kind of judoing bad ideas, not embarrassing or humiliating Pentagon ideas that maybe were a little off, but helping them find their way back on track. And I think that's consistent with how the other guest described him. The other point I would make is, from my experience, is Senator Reid was one of the very, very early proponents of cyber as a core mission set for DOD, particularly the Navy. He was a big supporter of the Naval Academy's Cyber Center, a big supporter of cyber up at the War College in Rhode Island. So, I mean, to the degree that you can kind of read into where his priorities are, I think that's important. As for the Navy, I think if the Navy can get its act together and can get a story and can get a plan, Chairman Reid could be a great proponent. Conversely, if they're schizophrenic and all over the place like they currently are, he could make life difficult for them, as he will insist upon them having a plan.
Byron, you've watched the Hill obviously for a long time. What's your sense on what these changes are going to mean? Because you put a thoughtful note out about change of power in Congress and what it means for the national security establishment.
A lot of ground has already been covered. I just want to make the point. I think it's interesting to see the market reaction to this, at least among the defense sector, and then what's happened in some of the other sectors of the market, because the large cap U.S. defense stocks, so Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, L3 Harris, they've all underperformed the market out of the box this year. And I think, you know, I really don't sense that defense spending expectations have changed as a result of the Georgia Senate races and their outcome, but the market is a relative game. And, you know, you factor in that there really are no budget caps this year. So this race between defense and non-defense discretionary spending, the Georgia Senate race has really tipped that heavily in favor of non-defense discretionary spending. And that's why you've seen these really amazing leaps in some of the stocks that are heavily exposed to infrastructure spending. Companies like Granite or Gibraltar Industries are literally up 30% this week on the election's outcome. And I think, you know, is that the right move? I can't tell you, but I think the flow of funds out of defense and into these other sectors that are more leveraged to what a Biden administration that has the power to do with a 50-50 split in the Senate, I think is the underlying story here for defense. I would agree with everything that's been said about Jack Reed and the appropriation side. I think is, I don't know, Leahy and Shelby seem to have a pretty good working relationship. So I don't think there are going to be many fireworks out from that. But I think the real story, the underlying story here for defense is this increased competition you're going to see from non-defense discretionary spending.
Byron, and I want to go to get Gordon and Dove's sense on this. President-elect looks like he's going to reorganize the National Security Council, return the role of a director for Russia, unsurprisingly eliminated by President Trump. There are going to be new China folks, as well as global health, human rights, and democracy. What do you think these changes mean? And then Gordon, want to get your take, and then Dove, yours. Gordon, I know you're very strong on whole of government and less militarized foreign policy, so want to get your take. But Byron, why don't you start us off?
Well, look, you know, there are puts and takes on this. I mean, one of the things that I could see certainly more focus on international arms transfers. You know, that's something we've talked about in the show in the past. The kind of democratic sweep we've seen, maybe that puts in a, you know, harsher light, particularly on some of the Middle East arms sales. But by elevating these issues like human rights, you know, and a sharper focus on Russia, I kind of see this as puts and takes for the defense sector. I'm not quite sure how this is all going to play out. But I think, you know, certainly this was an administration that was going to come in with a more expansive view of what really constitutes national security. And as much as maybe, you know, there could be frayed relationships in one part of the world, I don't see China or Russia reacting positively to maybe some of these changes that are being put in place right now in the National Security Council in particular.
Gordon?
I looked over what the reporting has been on this. I haven't seen any official statements on it, but it is an interesting set of shifts. There's some, I think, very promising ones. Some I have some questions about. Clearly adding issues that are not issues which demand kinetic responses like global health. There's a logistical defense end, obviously, but global health, good focus. Cyber, good focus too, although I hope in the context of that, that we'll have some tasking about cyber offensive operations and even, dare I say it, the possibilities of exploring international regimes to limit the threat to everybody. Not clear that that's going to happen. Russia, yes. China, yes. Makes sense. What I'm missing kind of here is two comments. One is what I'm missing is it's not clear from what's been reported so far how the domestic international meshing happens outside of the global health piece. I'm particularly concerned about issues like migration, immigration, and the economy. The international, the global economy, financial and fiscal issues, international efforts to deal with the disparity in wealth and income. There's a whole bunch of issues on the economy, and it's not yet clear to me how the NSC is going to deal with it. And I've seen no announcements with respect to the National Economic Council that might be the basket into which that's put. But it is a major crossover domestic international issue not clearly dealt with here. The other thing that I would raise is a question. I must say, I have my doubts about a senior director for democracy and human rights. We have been to this movie any number of times over the past 30 years of the United States trying to redefine its role as the leader of engaged in promoting, sponsoring, international applications of democracy, given recent events, but of course, given the last 4 years, we have so little to tell the rest of the world about how to run a democracy that even the notion of putting a major focus on global support for democracy, I'm going to want to see a lot more detail about what that means before I think that's an appropriate thing. The other question that's not clear to me from this restructuring is how this administration is going to look at the general broad scope of counter-terror operations, the uses of the special operations forces and the like. It's one of those areas where I am seriously concerned about overusing the military instrument, underusing the diplomatic and foreign assistance instruments, and lacking a coordinated strategy. And it's not clear how this NSC is going to grapple with that, but I think that's the kind of issue that's going to come back and bite them in the face, because those things are going to happen. And the question is, what's the United States' role going to be?
Dove, one of the criticisms of the Obama administration was a National Security Council that was too big, wielded too much authority, and was sometimes disorganized. As some folks would say, kids were in charge of things that should have been left to adults. Others say, hey, look, at least in a modern, fast-moving world, there were people who were specializing and expert in a variety of things that could give the president and the national security team and the cabinet better support more quickly. What's your sense on some of these changes and what they mean?
Well, I think that some of the people on the new National Security Council staff were victims of what you just discussed. Kurt Campbell's an adult, and he's going to bring a much more mature view of how to deal with Asia in general, where he's widely respected, and China in particular, than the last 4 years. Amanda Sloat is quite an expert on Europe, and I think she'll be important in getting us somehow back to dealing with the Europeans in a normal way. And you can't deal with the Europeans normally unless you're expanding beyond just military stuff. And I think I'm in the same place as Gordon. You've got to be much more attuned to the diplomatic and economic and nuances you have, and the social ones like immigration. And I think Sloat fully understands that immigration is a huge issue in Europe, just like it is here. More generally, I think that with Biden's closest advisor, Tony Blinken, over at State, I think, and someone who he knows, but clearly is not as close to running defense, I think that State will get a lot more importance. The real question in my mind is, okay, going beyond State, if you're talking whole of government, it means literally whole of government. It means Treasury and not just to impose sanctions. It means commerce. You've got to really look at the various agencies that have an international role that has really been subdued over the years by the Defense Department, essentially because DOD filled a vacuum. There was nobody else in many ways. And so I think there is a real opportunity now and an understanding that that vacuum has to be closed, and I think it will be.
Gordon, you had one final point you wanted to make?
Yeah, just to key off from what Doug was just saying, on the State Department, one of the important things is that team at the State Department has the opportunity to do something to restore the structure of that organization, whose problems vastly precede what happened to them under Tillerson and Pompeo. And the real key to that is going to be fixing both their sense of strategy and their ability to plan strategically, and particularly to fill the job of the second Deputy Secretary of State for Management and Resources. Really reworking the building and making it a powerhouse is going to depend on fixing a lot of internal problems. I'm doing a piece for Quincy on that that should be out in a bit about how to fix it at State. But filling that second deputy job is going to be critical. Trump did not fill it. It was filled in the Obama administration. They got waylaid by Afghanistan and other issues. But it needs to be filled because State really needs internal restructuring and management issues.
I should point out that Andrea Kendall-Taylor, who's going to be the new director for Russia and Central Asia, is also extremely competent, strategic, and thoughtful. Big loss for the Center for a New American Security, obviously, where she was one of the senior members on the team there. Let's transition to what happened on Wednesday. Michael, you spent a lot of time working with members and were in contact with some of them during the storming of the building and the ransacking of it. What's the mood? More unity, less recognition that pandering to the base, but largely a Republican base, with ever more violent imagery and statements and disinformation was going to be problematic. Joe Biden noted that, right? This should not have come as a surprise to anybody. Where are members? What do they think went wrong? And what's the way forward? Because it dissuaded some senators and members of Congress, for example, from falsely contesting the election. It didn't stop all of them, right? Josh Hawley, six Republican senators didn't change course. And, the fairly large number of Republicans in the House didn't.
Yeah, so look, this is unfolding by the minute still, and I think we have to see still what the full outcome and repercussions are going to be. But every range of emotions is being felt now. I mean, as we all see, there's a lot of talk about impeachment. The Pence and the cabinet did not invoke the 25th Amendment. In fact, articles of impeachment were drafted last night by the Judiciary Committee. And many Republicans, when asked about it, are not saying that they would oppose this. So I think that if the House does go forward with impeachment, which I believe they will next week, it will get some Republican support. And if it does end up going to the Senate for a trial, it's really a wild card to see what's going to happen. And it puts Republicans in a very tricky political situation because, depending on how they vote on this impeachment, could be used against them in campaigns 2 years from now, especially using footage of what happened on Wednesday. I was in touch with several members and staff during the riots, several who were holed up hiding in the garage. And then were escorted by SWAT teams out of the garage into some of the House office buildings. I was texting with one Republican member who was going to vote against certifying the electors and said, now I don't see how you can take that vote. And this really gives you an out, and your other members should take this out, and we need to tamp this down. And that member agreed with me and did not vote. And I can't say who he was. And he said to everybody, take his name off of everything. And then we saw a stark contrast between the House and the Senate, where McConnell really stepped up to try and tamp this down and put an end to it in the Senate. And half of the Republican senators who were going to oppose the electors that in the end did not oppose them. But the complete opposite happened in the House. And frankly, it was stunning. You know, it was projected that 140 Republican congressmen would oppose seating the electors. In the end, 138 voted to oppose seating the electors when it came to Pennsylvania. And it was 121 when it came to Arizona. And a lot of those people are on the Armed Services and Defense Appropriations Committees. And there's now, as of this morning, and actually even before this morning, a lot of fallout downtown among industry. You've seen already the National Association of Manufacturers, the Business Roundtable, other folks like that come out calling for either the removal of the president or to shut down their campaign contributions to people who voted to not seat the electors. And I'm starting to hear it from defense industry folks worried about whether they should or should not support these people. People, groups like the Lincoln Project are threatening to out these companies. They're already doing it today on Twitter, listing the companies that have given the most money to these members. So it's really spiraling out of control. And there is some concern that, you know, the Democrats could overstep by trying to shut down the Republicans' money. And also, do they end up overstepping on impeachment? But I don't see how the House can't take some kind of action against the president. And one of the things I regret not mentioning on our prediction show last week, because I had it in my notes and I forgot it, was I was going to predict that President Trump would not attend Biden's inauguration. And just 2 minutes ago, the president tweeted that he will not be attending Biden's inauguration, but that Pence will be.
I was about to say that, right? And in doing that, he joins what? John Adams, John Quincy Adams, and Andrew Johnson, if I'm correct, are the three preceding presidents who just left town instead of attending their successors' inaugurations. And Michael, will you please disabuse us of a notion that's now circulating among the very news sources of the people who actually were the terrorist insurgents, right? That this was not Antifa that did this.
Exactly. We know not only from the photographic evidence we've seen on TV, but from their own social media sites, that the folks that were sitting behind Pelosi's desks and, you know, stealing artifacts from the Capitol put themselves on social media. But it's stunning to see not only Hill staff that I speak to, but even members of Congress that are out there tweeting that this was Antifa and don't be too quick to rush to judgment. I think it gets back to our earlier discussion about getting back to where truth matters, and the disinformation that spreads to these people on the outside by being lied to by their government and the reactions that it causes.
Yeah. Do you think there's going to be any traction, right? I mean, both from Democratic and Republican members, we've heard that it's important to censure those who voted against certifying the election. I mean, do you think that there'll be any traction on that? Or is this something that's going to hit them in the wallet, for example, by potentially losing campaign contributions and otherwise being remembered, as Mitt Romney noted, right? How do you want to be remembered at this moment?
Right. Well, look, I think that there's a lot of hot feelings right now. A lot of people feel that there has to be action. And it's on both sides. I talked to a Republican chief of staff yesterday, to a member who just wants to know, what is it is his party going to do? What's going to be the course of action? And, you know, so people don't know. So we've seen obviously response to the lapse in security, where, you know, we've got the resignation of the sergeant at arms of the House, the sergeant at arms in the Senate, the resignation of the head of the Capitol Police. And I think that's just the beginning. But there has to also, I think, there's a sense of taking action against the president and people who were, they feel, fueled the flames and were responsible for this on Capitol Hill. But I think, you know, time heals all wounds. I think in time, whereas some people may not give political contributions to some of these folks, I think in time that will change. You know, look, if you're in an industry and one or two companies start to give, then the others have no choice but to follow. And there's the risk of repercussions. You know, I've already heard it this morning from members who I can't name that are threatening repercussions against folks, you know, that will not be giving contributions to them. So it's really a double-edged sword here. I think that
that's an ethics committee, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's an ethics investigation in the making.
These people
right
are
there.
Very careful about how they say it, the implication is very clear, right?
Right.
What the repercussions could be. So, and I think people are aware of that. So I think that, you know, everybody's got to take time will heal all these wounds.
Chris, let me bring you into the conversation, right? There are a lot of conclusions people were making. Why wasn't the building better defended? We discussed that a little bit. Why was the Pentagon dragging its feet from authorizing requests, not just from the mayor of the District of Columbia, where the Secretary of the Army is the boss of the Guard and not her, but requests from both the Virginia and the Maryland governors were slow rolled, right? I mean, the Pentagon's answer is, well, things went so badly in June, we didn't want this to happen again. But there's also a sense that the Pentagon and the administration was playing games with this, right? As many observed, if 30,000 Black people had been descending on the Pentagon with actually a legitimate grievance, there would have been bloodshed, right? Hundreds were arrested at peaceful Black Lives Matters protests and a heavy troop presence around time to prevent that. And yet armed insurrectionists who've been incited to violence descended on the Capitol and managed to ransack the place. More worrying is folks' concern that veterans, retirees, folks with military affiliation, wannabes, and militias sort of fueled by a somewhat glorification of the military have also not only played a role, but were very carefully stoked by the president and actually cultivated, right, for decades by the GOP, sadly. Right. What's your sense on what the underlying drivers here are and where we get to a better place ultimately? And I want to get, Gordon, your take on it, Dove, your take on it, and then Byron, your historical sense on this, because these things do not happen without enablers, right? And folks enabled the president and his rhetoric. And in fact, we've seen this happening for decades, unfortunately, on the Republican side. It's now constituted a base of tens of millions of people who are willing to become quite violent as what they view to be guardians of liberty, right? In the face of feckless civilians. Chris, why don't you start us off?
I'm struck by the last thing that Michael said. And I hope that time doesn't heal all wounds. And I understand the context that he used it in. But I think that there will be a kind of the classic American view that, hey, this isn't who we are, and this isn't, you know, we're better than this, and the American spirit will triumph, and there'll be some short-term actions, and then we'll kind of go on with business as usual. And I think if we do that, I think we will have missed this perfect storm of political or institutional problems, you know, as displayed by how President Trump came to power, how he acted while in power, and how he steamrolled the Republican Party. I think we'll miss the larger civil military divide and civil military issues that occur throughout the country, as seen by a 20-year war in Afghanistan that, for the most part, the American people are disconnected from, and really, for the most part, our policymakers are disconnected from. And then I think we'll miss the incompetence of our government at many levels. And so whether that's because the Defense Department wasn't quick enough, whether it's because the Capitol Police weren't savvy enough or were too racist to not prepare or not care who was marching on the Capitol. I think unless you look at this problem at all three of these levels, we are going to see similar problems occur more often as we play the whack-a-mole game of just focusing on one element of it. And you can already see it happening, right? I mean, there's a huge move, whether it's to impeach the president or whether it's the 25th Amendment. And then, you know, on another level, it's okay, so no more visits to the Capitol when Congress is in session, or better security. We are doing the same thing that we did after 9/11. We are treating the symptoms of this disease and not the cause. And if that's the approach we take, I think we're going to be in real trouble for the foreseeable future.
I think it's an interesting point you made, right? And also only small handfuls or a couple of dozen people were arrested, right? I should note Black Lives Matter's hundreds of protesters were arrested in short order, and many were just, again, peacefully protesting. Do you think that guns are an important part of this discussion as well? Because if you look at the minority, you know, a small number of people are the ones who have extremely large amounts of guns. And unfortunately, it is this demographic that is involved in that. Again, another group that's been pandered to, so much so, in fact, that if you talk to law enforcement, they're like, man, I mean, these militias and kooks are so heavily armed that we really can't take them on. And then there's a Waco fear. I mean, there's also a little police sympathy there as well, right? I mean, these groups are tolerated where maybe other heavily armed liberal groups might be somewhat less tolerated, right? Although you tend not to see that as much. You know, do you think that that plays a role in this debate as well? Because we're just unwilling to tackle that problem either.
I think it's a function of our unwillingness or inability to tackle a lot of issues. Guns may be part of it. I'll tell you, I'm a gun owner. I don't feel the need to march on the Capitol with the guns that I own. I think it's our inability to have an honest discussion about race. I think it's our inability to deal with the basic economic inequality in the country. I mean, I think, again, that's why I would say, look across all three levels of this and don't just focus on the incompetence of the Capitol Police or the poor decision-making at the Pentagon or the idiot that's in the White House. You really have to look at all of the factors that came together. And look, I know that's hard to do in the Twitter world and the world of hot takes, and it's exhausting. But if you don't look at all of those factors, we're going to be right back here, you know, when the next Trump is elected. And I think things will continue to get worse.
Byron, I want to go to you because unfortunately you've got to go to your next thing. Our conversation has been a little bit longer this week than it normally is, although we're dealing with extraordinary events. Bring your historian's eye to this, because throughout history, I mean, you know, Americans tend to be sort of baffled. How could this happen here? To Chris's point, right? You know, you say this isn't America. Well, this actually is America, right? I mean, it's part of America, and everybody is baffled. But if you look back at history, right, there was a guy called Adolf Hitler who was a demagogue, who was considered a kook, who ended up getting into the mainstream, got supported by enablers, ended up taking power, you know, and yet people were surprised. Like, how did that happen? I mean, it seems to be a regular reaction. What's your historian's eye to what we're seeing? What do you think the causes are? And where do you think we have to go in terms of a solution?
Boy, in 2 minutes. Okay, historically, where do I start? You know, when this all was happening, I was thinking, oh, this is the beer hall putsch in Munich that failed miserably. But, you know, look what happens 10 years later. So I kind of see the events of January 6th as part of a continuum. You know, it stretches back a number of years under the Trump administration. But, you know, you go back, I thought there was very little attention given to me, what was a suicide bomber in Nashville on Christmas Day that attempted to destroy an AT&T transmission station. And then earlier, I guess it was in October, you know, you had a plot broken up to kidnap the governor of Michigan. So this militarization of, and they are fringe groups, but I think to Chris's point, you know, if you really don't start getting at some of the underlying, what's causing this, like what's really, why are these behaviors being evidenced? I think, you know, we're going to be, I personally think we're going to see this worsen in 2021 and 2022. The passions that were displayed in the Capitol takeover, those aren't going to go away. And the more that people feel that this was a stolen election, I think increasingly they're going to revert to violence. And that's not good for the United States. It's not good for how the world perceives the United States. And it's certainly not going to make for safer cities or communities. So it really is a problem that we kind of poo-pooed. And I think, you know, we're going to mark a very swift transition from thinking about terrorism as a global problem you know, that primarily emanated from the Middle East to a domestic problem. And I don't know where that's going to start to influence federal spending. You know, it's not going to be a problem that's going to be solved by the Department of Defense. It's going to fall more squarely in the laps of the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI. But I think equally, you know, getting to these root causes of education, are there decent jobs? You know, why are people behaving the way they are? We've thought long and hard about this, about what causes radicalization in the Middle East. And I think we're going to need to see kind of a whole of government effort to really grapple with this in 2021, because it ain't going away. And I think it's going to get worse.
Let me just ask one brief follow-up, if I may, right? We talk often about sort of the power of hypersonic weapons and everything, but really information is the most powerful tool. And folks have understood that information, disinformation, misinformation are the most powerful tools, right? I mean, Joseph Goebbels would have told you that. And certainly there are now tens of millions of people who live, Byron, not in an educated information the pool in which we live, where we read conflicting stories and conflicting opinions, but are in an ecosystem that is completely disconnected from any.
Well, it's not just completely disconnected. I mean, to me, there are some really disgusting and disgraceful things that were evidenced in the Capitol. You know, people wearing T-shirts that said Camp Auschwitz. I mean, that kind of public display of, I don't know, you know, do you charge those people with hate crimes? I mean, there have to be very harsh penalties, at least to kind of tamp this back down and not allow it to be put on public display. And I think they're absolutely, I know we're going to get into a whole discussion, you know, you raised guns earlier, but really elemental civil rights of what's an appropriate freedom of expression. And I don't think wearing a T-shirt that says Camp Auschwitz should in any way, shape or form, you know, fall under that umbrella of free speech.
Byron, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Look forward to having your voice on this issue again in the future. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Gordon and Dove, you both have lived and taught politics. Gordon, let me go to you in terms of what you're what's your thoughts and how do we combat this? And Dove, you know, I'm interested sort of, you've had this issue with friends and family where, you know, as a conservative Republican, some of your family members have turned their backs on the party and in fact given you hell for, and your son, Roger, for remaining in the Republican Party, admirably trying to reform it from the inside. I know I've had this conversation with members of Congress, Adam Kinzinger and Mike Gallagher and others who are vexed by this and want to play a meaningful role in fixing it. Although there are some people who say, you know, look, I mean, fixing it now, you should have been fixing this before where you were, Dove. Gordon, give us your sense on where we are and what's the solution, right? What has to be next? Because Joe Biden is talking about unity and so is very reluctant to double down on impeaching Trump or, you know, how harshly we punish people who are being misled by a leader, right? The friend of mine was saying that just yesterday, right? That to an extent, they didn't blame the people. They have been incited by irresponsible leadership, right? But at the end of the day, they also broke the law, right? What's your sense on where we are and where we need to be and how we get there?
I got several thoughts, Bago, one of which is when we're dealing with sedition and insurrection, we're dealing with laws that actually exist on the books. And there is a place, there's a place in this. I mean, Michael said, time heals all wounds. Well, time also wounds all heals. There are some unsightly things that have gone on here, and they really should be punished in the reach of the law. And the actions that, so first off, the things that I was on a conference call late last night that the Speaker Pelosi and Adam Schiff talked at, and, you know, they recognize that asking for Trump's resignation is unlikely to happen, that Article 25 is probably not going to be invoked, and that impeachment is not going to go anywhere once it leaves the House, if the House has time to vote, and it will take time to put it together anyway. But the point that they made last night in the call was, these are, you know, it's our intention to use these various approaches to tie these guys in knots for the next 13 days so they don't do something crazy. So it's one piece of an approach to the issue.
They underestimate his ability to go full crazy. But,
I admire it. For 4 years, they have consistently underestimated his ability to go full crazy, but that's what they think they are doing.
I would call it multi-channel crazy, right? He's a signal hopping crazy. Continue though.
On the politics of this, you know, the Sedition Caucus, Hawley, Cruz, people like that, that rose up in the House at 138 members and in the Senate at 8 members, there ought to be some price to be paid for basically coddling and attempting to overthrow a legitimate and thoroughly certified vote. I don't think it's going to go to the point of expulsion. And frankly, expulsion is the only real censure that that the Hill can give its members. And it requires 2/3 vote of the members. I suspect that's not going to happen. I think it might be appropriate for it to happen. And I don't know what you do with human political pretzels like Lindsey Graham, who has been on every side of Donald Trump you could possibly find over the last 5 years. But in the end, there needs to be some kind of action. That's our next step with respect to the people who've disgraced the American political process and their offices, in my judgment. The other thing to keep in mind here is that these issues continue. It's not like there is a step of things that will happen in the next 2 weeks and then it's all behind us. The issue of race is not behind us. Everybody knows and recognizes that the response of the Capitol Police to this intrusion was vastly different from Black Lives Matter responses, from what's happened in America's cities, what happened in the Capitol when the president walked to the church. There is a clearly racist element in the way this was dealt with, and that issue has not gone away. We also have a clearly uncontrolled right, a far right, and it's one of the reasons that I think speaking out about it and coming down hard on it in the legal context is absolutely appropriate. But there are also an ongoing set of efforts, and here I think the Republican Party has a lot to answer for at the federal level and at the state and local level, an ongoing effort to disenfranchise the electorate. Raffensperger, the Secretary of State of Georgia, won great applause for standing up to the president. At the same time, he's introducing a bill this week that would further restrict the capability of Georgians to vote. And he tried to take 300,000 people off the Georgian voting rolls. So this effort, stimulated by the Republican Party at the state and local level especially, but coordinated nationally through ALEC and other places, is going on. And then there's the last issue that you raised as well, which I think is an important and underlying issue. And that has to do with civil-military relations. Chris talked about this, and I absolutely agree with him. There's a whole set of issues that the president, I think, is going to have to be very clear about in terms of the uses of the American military in non-military matters, whether it's using funding, whether it's deploying forces to the border, whether it's intervening in urban situations, whether it's clarifying the uses of the National Guard. There are a whole bunch of issues tucked in here that we've kind of gotten used to people talking about letting the military do it, that we're going to have to, I think, revisit. And I'm hoping that people on the Hill will want to revisit that, including the new chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee. But it's a fundamental underlying set of issues that now need to be dealt with, and they're ongoing. So this is not over simply because the insurrection in the Capitol failed, and it did fail, and it was an insurrection. It betrays an underlying set of issues like you've raised guns, like what do we do about extremist ideologies, about information stovepipes. There's a whole bundle of issues that we're going to have to unwrap over the next 2 years.
I would put better redistricting so that members aren't picking voters, which leads to greater polarization and moves people away from the center. But the civil military discussion is all too often, anytime you try to raise it, is why do you hate the troops? Well, wait a minute. That's not what we're saying. We're saying everybody serves in their own way. We appreciate and thank and admire and respect people for military service. But at the end of the day, what's happened in the last 20 years is we got everybody into stupid wars. We fought them stupidly. Our solution was, I don't want my kids to go, but that guy's going, and I'm going to lavish all sorts of benefits on that person for going instead of me, which then gets to the heart of national service and to the point that Mike Mullen has always talked about, I think, exceptionally thoughtfully. How do you keep society connected to the military and grounded to the military? How do you keep the military grounded to society so that they don't regard themselves as a silver class, a guardian class, an auxiliary class in Plato's terms, that doesn't think itself superior to the society it serves, which is I think a little bit part and parcel of the challenge. Dove, we're running short on time, but why don't you bring us home on this conversation?
Well, a number of things. First, you mentioned the gerrymandering, and I think that until something is done about that, and it won't be for some time, you're going to have people from deep red districts and people from deep blue districts. Unfortunately, for the nation, you seem to have more people coming from the deep red districts, the 130, 140 people who supported Trump to the end, than you do on the blue side, but you probably have some 50 people like AOC. Of course, the good news is that still leaves 200 some odd people that have to be careful because they're from purple districts. And of course, in the Senate, it's even harder to act as if you were a House member. And that brings me to Cruz and Hawley. I think the ultimate question is going to be whether one of these two guys is nominated. And if they are, the Republican Party might split. Let me say something about my party. I've been getting all the Trump emails, fundraising emails, and those are supported by the RNC and with Ronna McDaniel, who has been a Trump follower, even though she's Romney's niece. And those things talk about every one of them is addressed to a patriot, and every one of them talks about the communists and the socialists that are going to take over the country if the Democrats win. Now, unless the RNC just met down in Palm Beach, I think it was, and they gave Trump a hero's welcome. That is going to have to change if the Republican Party is to remain anything like a true small D Democratic Party. I think that's where things are going to have to start. And I think companies that will, for instance, cave to some member of the Armed Services Committee and give them money no matter what they say or do, really will have to be held accountable. The other thing I think that people need to realize is that there is a model for a very different kind of Republican Party, and it doesn't have to go that far back. Whatever you think about the wars that George W. Bush started, no one ever accused him of being a racist or an anti-Semite or anything like that. Quite the contrary, he personally attacked them. I heard him say that in private as well as in public. And this was a guy who got 40% of the Latino vote in Texas. There is a model for a very, and he's still around. There is a model for a very different kind of Republican Party. So that's one of the major questions. The other question I think is, what do the Democrats do now that they can investigate and hold hearings? Do they try to change the gun laws, for example? This is their opportunity to do this. Do they investigate how the Defense Department did or did not do what they should have done on the January 6th? And then what do they propose in terms of fixing it? It's not simply a matter of saying, oh, the Republicans are bad and that's it. You want to fix things. This is the opportunity. They've got both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. And by the way, why don't they raise the issue of national service? Mike Mullen is right. Why don't we get people to do national service? Give 2 years to your country. It's not going to kill you, but it's going to put you together with other people and get that you've never met before, that have lived very different lives, that look different, speak different, and will get you to recognize that you owe the country something. It doesn't owe you. This is the opportunity for Democrats, whether they pick it up or not, whether Republicans clean up their act, that's the open question.
It's certainly going to be interesting, right? Because I think as many people, and I think I've heard you, Dove, say this, right? I mean, to an extent, the GOP did this. The GOP has to play a much more central role in sorting it out. The question is, can it be sorted out? And what other legal mechanisms have to go into place? Because as a reporter, every legitimate reporter, and I say this because this sort of citizen investigative journalism can be very misleading and very problematic and agenda driven. I'm not saying reporters don't have issues and agendas, but the founding fathers put the First Amendment in, recognizing that only a factually informed electorate can make the best decisions. And at the end of the day, if you're going to have a democracy, you need actual forms of reliable information. And at the end of the day, as long as those arms of information are polluted, then it's going to be very, very problematic. And I have to add one other thing, which is that the word patriot, the fundamental thing that should characterize our nation, has become almost the dog whistle, right? If somebody calls somebody a patriot, it's almost like it's a code word for something. And that is, to me, the most disgusting, that some of the most important elements of iconography of America have now been misappropriated by people. The Betsy Ross flag, the American flag, the notion of patriot, the Gadsden flag, don't tread on me. All of these things are sort of traditional American symbolism that's been misappropriated and then used as weapons against the very institution that stands in the way of tyranny. I mean, it's just extraordinary. Gentlemen, thanks very, very much for joining us. Appreciate it very much. And would love to have you guys back on again next week. Have a great weekend. And I've got my fingers crossed that nothing crazy happens in the next week, but I'm almost assured that it will. Thanks again.
Thanks, Vago.
Thanks, Vago.
Thanks, Vago.
Thank you, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.